You make man like me?
No. Woman. Friend for you.
Woman. Friend. Yes. I want friend like me.
I think you can be very useful. And you will add a little force to the argument if necessary. Do you know who Henry Frankenstein is and who you are?
Yes, I know. Made me from dead. I love dead. Hate living.
You're wise in your generation.
We're back on the Scare Value Podcast with one of my all-time favorite movies that Pete seems eternally befuddled that I enjoy.
You know what? I watched it for the first time since I was a wee little Pete, and I remain befuddled.
Really?
What? Okay. I guess I should have watched the first one first. What?
I think you know what happens.
Yeah, Frankenstein gets made, and then he throws Dr. Frankenstein off the building of the windmill that burns down, or is that all not real?
That happened.
Okay, that's what I thought, because that was the little flashback we got at the beginning.
Originally died at the end of the movie, but they thought the movie looked good, so they kept him alive before they did a reshoot to keep him alive, just in case.
Okay.
And then 5 years later, 4 years later, it ended up coming back against the wishes of everybody.
All right, so why what makes it so good? What is it about it?
Well, Pete, that's not where we're going to start.
Okay, well, then you tell me. This is the Brian, show and tell hour.
Yeah, I'm Brian. That's Pete.
I can't prove it in court.
I can probably get that proven.
I don't know. You can try.
So it's been mentioned in this podcast many times that I am the least read person that has the ability to read.
Oh, I thought you meant like skin color, because you are very pale. There's no color in that skin. You're like a ghost.
I'm not that pale. I've read 17 books in 45 years.
Yep.
And now, Pete, I've read 18 books.
What the what?
For the first time in what I assume is at least 8 years, I read a full-on 300-plus page book.
All right. Well, obviously, what book? That's the question I need to know.
And four of those 17 books were Ty Cobb biographies.
There were that many biographies about one person?
There's more. That's as many as I could read.
Oh, okay. Jeez.
A fascinating individual. I read the biography of James Whale, director of Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein.
Okay.
He has always fascinated me because of his time period of making films, how he got stuck making horror.
I don't know any of the story of James Whale.
Well, good news, Pete. I read a book.
Okay. Well, can you talk about the book or did you just read it? Because
I got to talk. Is it a book report now?
Yeah, it's a book report like thing. I once did a book report on, oh man, it was somehow, I can't remember the name of the book, but the alligator egg ended up in a bird's nest and the alligator grew up thinking it was a bird. And then it tried to fly, and it didn't, and it fell into the water.
Isn't this that episode of television you told me about where the turkey looked up?
No, that was a different thing with another. No, that was just a giant turkey that was mutated. This is an alligator who thought he was a bird, but I can kind of see the connection.
Which sounds like a better book.
What, the James Whale book or the one about an alligator trying to learn to fly?
The book I made up about the turkey, mutated turkey, or learning how to fly.
Ooh, see, but it's already a TV show. Oh, you're going to do the novelization of the episode of whatever show that was?
Yes.
All right, I'm on board.
James Whale was born in poverty at the ending days of Victorian London.
Ooh, Jack and the Ripper.
He was creative, but that was not encouraged much around the parts where they sent kids off to work very young.
Because it's not useful.
And he had to work from a young age, and he saved up to go to an art school. He began as a painter and then got into directing theater.
This is all in England?
This is all in England when there's really not that much movie production going around England, and none of it has sound. So it's the silent film era in England. Hollywood has started making sound pictures.
Is this what, the 10s, the 20s?
This would be pre-World War One.
So the aughts.
Sure. When did World War I start?
1911? No, 14? When did they sink the Lusitania? World War One? Let me think here. Go back to history.
So he gets forced into World War One. Ended. That's where we are.
In 17.
He gets forced into World War One, and he gets captured. And while he's captured, that's where he starts putting on plays, because they're all stuck
That's all right.
And here's the other crazy part. He wins a lot of money in card games and IOUs, and he kind of spends his post-war years living off the IOUs he won while they were in camp.
So everyone was paid up, yes, in essence.
He went and collected all his debts. So he actually he learns stagecraft, and he gets some money to get a start while he's trapped in confined spaces with the other soldiers.
So he just found like other people who are interested in theater to help him put on these plays, I'm guessing.
What else were they going to do?
Yeah, that's fair.
So he also sold paintings that he painted during the war. So that's, he really, his creative boost came from becoming a prisoner of war.
Well, that freed up his time.
Sure. And then he pursued acting in theater first. And then that's how he made his way through, where he was kind of better at set design than anything, which I think you can see in the, his attention to set design is what makes the Frankenstein movie so memorable in one way.
Yeah, that's very true. There's a bunch of iconic stuff in there. The laboratory,
that's all his,
the windmill, the castle.
It's all his big thing, is that he wants it to look a certain way. He gets his real breakthrough is a play about the war, and it's all in one set. It's called Journey's End. So in the production of that, he meets Colin Clive, who becomes Henry Frankenstein. And before that, even, he meets Ernest Thesiger, who becomes Dr. Pretorius. And he meets Elsa Lanchester, who becomes Mary Shelley and Bride of Frankenstein.
Oh, that was the same actress?
Yes.
Okay.
He meets these people. I
thought they looked similar.
He meets these people while coming up through theater. And actually, Laurence Olivier was the original star of Journey's End for the previews. And then he was only 21 years old at the time. And he only took it to get a bigger role in something else. And he got it immediately because he's one of the great actors of all time. And that's how Colin Clive came in. So he meets Colin Clive. Now, there's a downside to this. Well, Colin Clive is this very charismatic and enigmatic actor. He has real shakes about going on stage. So someone teaches him how to drink. And he'll be dead by 1937 from drinking.
Oh, to calm his nerves kind of thing?
Yes.
So he was drunk on everything?
Yes.
And all the filming?
It was bad. And like I said, Bride of Frankenstein is 1935. He'd be dead within 2 years.
So he was drunk during all of this in Bride of Frankenstein that we just watched?
Yeah. So when Frankenstein comes out, he's got like a real big future in front of him. He looks like a leading man. He looks like he's got everything that you want on stage. He's very, especially for the time, he's very charismatic and very, you know, everybody talks about Brando changed acting from the stage acting to the more naturalistic acting. Colin Clive's kind of got all of it, and he's really kind of ahead of his time. By the time Bride of Frankenstein comes around, he's kind of down to just that one note. He's kind of drank it away to where he can just be eccentric, but that's the note that Whale needs, so he just is like, we'll just use it.
I can see the charisma there, though, because there's an intensity. Yeah, there's something that you really watch him, and the part in the lab with the lab coat where he's looking up with his head turned, I've seen that everywhere, and I never realized it's Bride of Frankenstein. Yep.
So Journey's End is what gets him from the West End in England to Broadway, as he produces it for Broadway, and it becomes a hit. And it also gets him to Hollywood, and his first movie is a film adaptation of Journey's End.
Okay.
But now he's like, I want to get away from this war stuff. Like, all I'm getting kind of pigeonholed into, I spent now 2 years working on this one play. It's made me, you know, a star.
This is Whale?
Yeah. And he wants to go to Hollywood. And before he actually makes, he's courted by Hollywood. Before he actually makes Journey's End, which becomes his first real movie, Howard Hughes hires him to reshoot parts of the movie Howard Hughes spent all those years making, Hell's Angels. Because in the time he was making the movie, movies started becoming, everybody had to have talking in their movies. And because James Whale came from England, working with the stage actors and knew how to rehearse actors, and was kind of his first jobs in Hollywood before he got to direct, he was a dialogue director. He would work with the actors so he hired him to shoot that. He doesn't get credit for it really, but that's kind of a famous movie. It's the big Howard Hughes movie that he did. And James Whale, before he did anything, before he was known to anybody, was actually cutting together 30% of that movie with all the sound.
Okay. So he's got credentials now.
Yes, and he walks into Hollywood just in time for the Great Depression.
Yay!
And it doesn't actually affect Hollywood that quickly. People are using it as an escape to go to the movies, so movies are still doing okay for a while.
Okay.
So he starts making some money, and he doesn't spend a lot. So he actually ends up, even though he has a short career, retiring very wealthy. He goes to Paramount for 3 months before he gets to Universal. And there he learns all kinds of film techniques that are about to be completely obsolete. Everything's changing so fast in Hollywood that he's learning three camera setup techniques, and none of this is going to be the way that we do things. In fact, he's going to become one of the more interesting directors of moving the camera. And it's going to be like a big, not controversy, but almost like a fight between people that think camera movement is a thing that you want and people that hate it.
You know, now that you bring that, this is in the 30s, right? When did Frankenstein or Bride of come out?
35,
right. I'm thinking back to the movies from the 60s and stuff. It's a lot of just stationary camera, or 50s rather.
Yes, this is all such experimental stuff. And he's taking stuff he's seen in German expressionism and bringing it to the screen.
Was that how it was before? Because it was the beginning. Was it all static? Like you said, there's that fight between the two.
Again, when he gets there, it's all been almost silent films before that. So it's basically been a stationary camera. Then they figured out three cameras so you could film it all at once and cut it together later, however angle you need.
Okay.
But that's not how we'd make movies. During the time he's learning to make movies, the way that movies are made changes. And he's got to learn all that. But what he brings to the table that other people don't is that theater background. So he does things very differently than everybody else. He always ends up over budget. And he always ends up over a lot of time because he spends a lot of time with the actors rehearsing scenes as if it was a play. So by the time the cameras are rolling, he's ready to go. And he actually can shoot fairly efficiently. It's just that, you know, he knows kind of what he wants. He knows how it's going to cut together in his head, which is very advanced for the time, especially when the medium barely exists.
Okay.
When he's doing it. In fact, when Frankenstein's made in 1931, there's no score in Frankenstein. They didn't know how to put multiple audio tracks together yet.
Oh.
And then Bride of Frankenstein has one of the more famous scores of all time. It's kind of incredible just in that short period to see how much film has changed.
It's one of the most famous scores of all time?
Yes.
More than the Crow soundtrack?
That's not a score. That's a soundtrack. Because you're thinking about Stone Temple Pilots right now.
I am thinking about the Stone Temple Pilots right now. I didn't know that, though. That is, it makes sense, though, because it stands out. The orchestra is memorable.
He makes a movie called The Kiss Before the Mirror, where he kills the leading lady in the opening scene, something that wouldn't be done again until Hitchcock, who actually does it 45 minutes in, and then became a thing that Scream did. So he's so far ahead of the curve on this. And do you know who that leading lady was?
Barbara Walters.
Close.
That was the oldest person I could think of.
She's dead now. So, by the way, update. Everyone involved with Bride of Frankenstein has passed away.
I worried.
It's Gloria Stewart, who you might know is the old lady from Titanic.
The one who threw the necklace away?
Yes.
After wasting everyone's time and effort?
Yes.
Well, joke's on you. I don't remember her that well. Wait, so, who was she?
The old lady on Titanic. She was the leading lady that got killed in his movie. And he uses her in other movies. He uses her in The Old Dark House. If I remember right, it's The Old Dark House, and she's the star of it. So what happens is Dracula comes out in 1931 and becomes a big hit. Carl Laemmle Jr., the son of the studio head of Universal, thinks, I think there's money in these horror movies. And he faces resistance from his father. He faces resistance from directors in the Universal, he faces from critics. They just think it's a one-off. It'll never hit again.
So Dracula was the first of the Universal monsters.
And it's a big hit, but it inspires no other studio to make a horror movie. They all think it's just not a thing that's going to work. When Frankenstein hits, everybody follows suit. That's what launches horror. So James Whale's first Frankenstein movie is kind of where Carl Laemmle Jr. sees the whole thing going. And he's gonna win in some and lose some. Let's put it that way. He'll be out fairly quickly, too, even though he kind of succeeds at the things he tries that society doesn't want him to make.
Okay. That sounds big and important.
Yeah. Frankenstein changed a lot of things. And one thing it changed was that James Whale thought he could start making movies he wanted to.
He had too much control?
He had no problem.
Not enough?
He had no problem making Frankenstein. It's just that he doesn't want to only be making horror movies. So they make a deal where if he makes a horror movie, he can make a movie that he wants to make, which is how he makes The Invisible Man. But at the same time, he gets to make something that he wants to make because he's made Invisible Man.
So he has no problem. So did he like the horror stuff that he was writing then?
I don't think he felt one way or another about it.
So he was just writing them.
He didn't write it.
Well,
he's a director.
Directing them, yes.
Yeah. He kind of gets to do the things he wants to do, but the things he wants to do, he never gets full cut of. Something always gets messed up. This is pre-code era. It's another thing. Frankenstein comes out pre-code. Bride of Frankenstein is like the first major movie that is susceptible to the new code where they're going to crack down on every little thing you do.
Okay.
So much is changing in such a short amount of time for him. The projects he gets to work on that are more passion projects than going back to the well of horror for the third and fourth time, he never kind of gets full control over them. Something always comes up where you know, we have to take this out. This is against this rule. We have to cut this. We have to cut that. They change his endings. And the only movie he seemed to have complete full control over ended up being Bride of Frankenstein, because they were so desperate to get him back. And he did not want to come back. He did it to get another movie made. He didn't think there was anything left in the story. So we made it. It was great. He didn't shy away from it. He loved making Frankenstein, but he's like, we did it. What are we doing? And Carla didn't want to talk. So now they're at a crossroads where neither of them kind of wants to do the project they're lining up to do. But Whale's like, you're going to talk because we have to do something different. And I think you can give more sensitivity to the monster. And Karloff's like, I think you give less because it worked the first time. So they don't get along that great. And he kind of doesn't love Karloff as much as history would lead you to believe.
Okay.
He uses him because he's a star. But he also is like, he doesn't really respect his opinion on it. And the funny thing is that Karloff's even been quoted as saying that, like, well, I guess he was right. I mean, the movies are, you know, like 40 years later, he's talking about it. He's like, this is all everybody wants to talk about. I guess he was right.
Okay.
So he makes The Invisible Man, and it becomes another hit right when Universal needs one. Because other stuff that's going on that's not Lemley Jr.'s horror movies are starting to bomb. But Invisible Man brings them back and gets them a profit. And it's the only movie during H.G. Wells' lifetime that he approved of after having seen it. He was a real stickler for how bad these movies were coming out. He didn't want to just give the rights to everybody. But he was actually in England promoting it alongside James Whale when the movie opened in England. So it's like the one movie that they're like, he made a good one.
Okay, so James Whale is responsible for a lot of the Universal monsters.
I think that you can argue it. People will say, I don't think you can argue outside of three of the top five, but I think he made the three best Universal monster movies. I think that Bride of Frankenstein's number one.
Obviously.
I think Frankenstein's number two. And I think Invisible Man's number three. And some people like to throw in Wolfman and Dracula. I don't think they're as good as those movies. I don't think they're as visually interesting. I know that they're not as exciting.
What about Gilman?
I just watched the Gilman movie recently, and it's pretty good. But it's also very out of date.
Like I haven't seen it, you know.
No, I mean, forever. It doesn't feel like the other Universal Monster movies because it's made in the 50s.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
So it doesn't feel like it's even the same thing anymore. And it, for the 50s, it feels very, if you'll pardon the pun, shallow.
Well, it is a swamp.
That's what I mean. If it had come out in the 30s, it might have been played better. So,
but everyone was depressed, so.
Mainly, he just doesn't want to be pigeonholed into horror anymore. He's known for these horror movies, and he wants to do something new. And Bride of Frankenstein is the least new thing he can do. It's literally a sequel. And that's one of the reasons that I love it so much. It's not the first sequel ever. I think it might be the best sequel ever. It's in that conversation.
Why?
Well, we'll get to it.
Okay.
Though it's not the first sequel ever, it does have to do things that nobody's thought of before. For example, they have to figure out how to start the movie, and they want to give a recap of Frankenstein, and they design a pretty elegant way of doing it. When that movie opens, we meet Mary Shelley in a cabin in the house with Percy Shelley and Lord Byron,
yep.
Which is a recreation of how they came up with the story in the first place. And she's like, oh, there's a second part of that story. I didn't tell it. And Byron runs down the plot of Frankenstein with scenes for Frankenstein. This hasn't been done before. This is something that Friday the 13th would have to copy over and over again.
So, this literally is the start of the recap.
Yes.
Previously on.
And I don't know that anyone's ever come up with a more interesting way to do it, to pull it out of the story, to give it back to the creator, and then to have the creator explain that there's another part of the story that I left out.
But then it never cut back to them again.
Why would you? She's telling the story.
Yeah, but I'd like to go, oh, that was a good story. Thanks for part two.
You want to change the ending of Bride of Frankenstein?
I'd like to go back to where we started.
The 3 minutes that not only defined 50 years of horror, but inspired people like Guillermo del Toro and Neil Gaiman to become artists. It's their number one. You want to go back and have Elsa Lanchester back in her Mary Shelley costume go, and the end.
And then the other people say, yeah, that was pretty good. That was a good story. Thank you. I'm not saying clearly these people were inspired, and I like all of the people you named, but imagine how much more inspired they would have been if the ending were slightly different.
I bet Percy Shelley would have said some bullshit.
He probably would have.
Byron was like really into the story, and Percy was like, it's so cute she does things.
Right? He seems super disdainful of his wife. Right? It was crazy.
It was. Also, she calls him Shelley. I'm like, that's your name, too. That doesn't make any sense.
There are a lot of confusing things about the power dynamics that were going on, because Mary Shelley was the one that we all like better. So, like, this is fascinating. You've created this, you're the birth of sci-fi.
Birth of everything, really. Mary Shelley.
Right. Yeah. And look at her. And you've chosen to go this way with your direction. Is it part of just the society at the time, do you think? Or is it just...
Well, she didn't even have her name on the original publication.
Wait, what? Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. You mean in the book?
Yeah, it didn't show up till the second printing.
No kidding. Yeah. Look at you dropping book knowledge on me that I didn't know.
Well, that's even a book I have read, too. That's one of the 17 I've read, Frankenstein. Or the modern Prometheus.
I saw that I, Prometheus with Aaron Eckhart.
Ooh.
Or was it I, Frankenstein? Yeah. I saw that one.
I did not. I, like most of the country, did not.
I don't remember a single thing about that movie. I feel like they could fly.
Cover. I remember the cover.
With his face?
But he's like a half turn.
Yeah, you know why?
Because he's two-faced.
Yeah, the other half is all messed up and they can't have that.
They just never had those makeup effects off.
Nope.
So you got a director who doesn't want to make the movie, a star who doesn't want to act in the way that they want him to act, and multiple bad scripts along the way. They wanted to make a sequel to Frankenstein since before Frankenstein came out. That's why they made sure the ending allowed for Henry Frankenstein to live.
Right. They didn't have a script. They just said, we want to leave it open. So that trait goes back all the way to the beginning of Hollywood. Cliffhangers.
Yes. And this is before sequels are a thing that's even known. Dracula didn't get a sequel till well after Bride of Frankenstein. It wasn't a thing that was happening. But they knew they had something with Frankenstein. And James Whale's like, great, I want to do Showboat. I want to make a musical. And he does get to do Showboat. Probably because he made Bride of Frankenstein.
But, you know, I only know him for horror. Did anything else land? Was he known for anything at the time or now? Or
yeah, he got really good notices and none of his work's available outside of these horror movies.
No kidding.
You can go on right now and you can find The Old Dark House. You can find Frankenstein. You can find Bride of Frankenstein. You can find Invisible Man. You cannot find Showboat.
Is that a license or just no one gave a shit ever? Do they even exist?
Everything exists. The only thing that's believed to be destroyed is the last thing he ever did, which was a 40-minute long short for inclusion in like a serial movie they would have put together or maybe for television. And no, I think that might exist. You just can't find it. The only thing that was destroyed was a war movie he made that was a short war movie during World War II, which was after he'd retired. But they destroyed all the ones that they didn't think had historical value. And he was, and even in 1992, they were like, who? It's just the way it was. Even though at the time he was seen as one of the best directors in the country.
And this was in 92. People still didn't.
Yes.
He wasn't reckoned that.
Yes.
When did people start to recognize his influence?
I'm not sure because that stunned me when I found out it was 1992 and they destroyed his short.
Because I remember you being all about him in the 90s.
Yeah, maybe it could just be that someone didn't know who he was when they decided made that decision.
Oh,
yeah. You had the wrong person making the choice.
Yeah.
But like John Ford made one of those and got to keep that. It's a John Ford movie. And nobody thought the same thing for James Whale, who did drop out of society in 1941. It's not like anybody was watching James Whale movies. In 92, the person making that decision never grew up with a James Whale movie. So,
okay.
So
that's how we got there.
So that's how the movie gets made, is that he has to agree to do it to get, it wasn't.
Whatever he wanted to get done.
Yeah. Whatever movie it was, he says, fine, I'll come back and do this movie. It's the only one he gets full control over in his entire career, which is fascinating because it's, again, I don't think he ever walked into any project. There was ones where he didn't want to do them. He just had to do them. And he would kind of just be like, whatever, and I put that much effort into it. But he goes full out with this movie. He puts all his effort into
it. So did the script come to, like, he was just the director. So the script came to him. How did they, were there changes while that was going on? Or did he have any control over the script?
You know, he could veto the ones he was getting. So I think it took five passes until he got something that he thought was worth doing.
Oh, all right, and I see.
The thing was, they weren't all doing Bride of Frankenstein. They were just doing Frankenstein Returns and then trying to find reasons that Frankenstein's monster's walking around. The last person finally just went back to the book and pulled out all the stuff they didn't put in about the mate for the monster. And it's like, it seems like a natural thing to do. But here's the thing about that. And this is one of the reasons that James Whale has always fascinated me. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is one of the most iconic things in literature. When you think about Frankenstein, you're not thinking about her Frankenstein.
No,
you're thinking about James Whale's Frankenstein.
I'm thinking about the bolts in the head and
he rewrote
Long Dead.
He rewrote one of the most famous things, and the way that you picture it now, when someone makes a faithful adaptation of her book, it feels wrong.
it does. That is interesting, and that's a point I have never thought about before.
What happened was Mary Shelley's Frankenstein was in the public domain. But they optioned a play based on Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which is where a lot of the ideas from the original Frankenstein 1931 come from. They're just filming the play, basically, which has cut out a lot of the things, and it's made the monster more the one we recognize. So really, that kind of should go to the playwright. But the visual parts go to Whale, because he's the one who put him on film, and Karloff, and Jack Pierce, who did the makeup.
I'm trying to think back to anything else where there's that kind of
it's insane
shift in your perception.
It's completely insane, because it's not just a slight shift. When I saw Mary Shelley's Frankenstein in 1994 by Kenneth Branagh, I was like, this is bullshit. The monster.
Is that Robert De Niro?
And the monster's just talking eloquently, yes. And I'm like, this is nonsense. That's what happens in the book. But nobody wants that.
No. You know what? You're right, because I'm thinking back to good old Monster Squad.
Yes.
You know what? I don't want a goddamn almost human thing running around.
I want Frank. I want exactly what I got in Bride of Frankenstein. That's the amount of speech I want. And I like it better than Frankenstein, partially because of the speech, to be honest. But I think it's Karloff's best performance. But he's great in Frankenstein as well.
I always thought Herman Munster talked too much.
That's the thing. Munsters, everything is from this version of it. That's not Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. That's James Whale's Frankenstein.
100%. And then there was no faithful adaptation of the book until, what, 94?
I'm sure the people were doing things in the 80s. I remember some ones I didn't see. I think Raul Julia's in one where they were doing more.
I don't remember any of that.
More of those kind. But even now, when you see those things, it still doesn't feel right. The movie's 89 years old? Yeah. Freddy Frankenstein's 89 years old. Frankenstein's 93 years old. But it's the definitive text now.
Yeah, it is. I'll agree. That's an interesting take. I can see the fascination.
The other reason that I love Bride of Frankenstein so much, my number one and number two reason. Number one is Dr. Septimus Pretorius.
Yeah, what is his deal? He's great.
He's incredible.
So, he's insane.
The number two reason is because of, we'll get back to the things it does as a sequel that I find so fascinating. Because it wasn't just giving you more of the same. It took into context what happened in the original movie, and then characters grew and learned and changed from it, which was never happening in a sequel before that. Every sequel prior to that was just put a two on it, tell me the same movie again.
Okay.
This Henry Frankenstein is a ruined and changed man. He is not on board with doing these experiments. He has learned a lesson.
Yes, he seemed to waver back and forth.
He did not waver back and forth. He only does it because Elizabeth gets taken by the monster.
Yeah, and why was he so angry? Frankenstein started the movie a lot angrier than I ever remember him being.
The monster?
Yeah, the monster.
Because he just got persecuted to near death.
Oh, that's, you know.
Now, here's the thing about Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein that works as like a palindrome almost. Frankenstein basically begins with the creation of the monster, and then it ends with the angry townspeople. Bride of Frankenstein begins with the angry townspeople, and it ends with the birth of the monster. It's fascinating to watch the way those go.
But the movie ends with them dying again, right?
Right. Well, I mean, the movie begins, Frankenstein begins before the experiment. But the main thing in the first act of Frankenstein is the birth of the creation of the monster.
Right.
The main thing in the third act of Bride of Frankenstein is the creation of the bride.
Right. Okay.
And the third act of Frankenstein is the angry villagers. And the first act of Bride of Frankenstein is the angry villagers. It's a fascinating.
Yeah, it's a continuous stream of a movie.
Yes. And Pretorius exists because Henry Frankenstein isn't the same man anymore.
Was Pretorius in the first one?
No.
Okay.
He is just enthralled by the idea that a person that he used to know, another person he used to work with, Henry Frankenstein, has succeeded where he's failed. Yeah. And he is obsessed.
I like that he only has one vice for many, many different things.
That's humor that you weren't getting
in 1935. That was really solid.
That's pure Ernest Thesinger, from what I understand.
Okay.
So Ernest Thesinger is very much like James Whale, two people working in Hollywood who are openly gay, and they're not hiding it. Which is one of the reasons that attempting to read the gay subtext into these movies is tough to do, because he doesn't feel like an outcast, James Whale. He doesn't care. Who knows? He doesn't hide it. He doesn't flaunt it. He's not running around in people's faces. But he's also like, he openly lives with a man. He's never pretending to be with a woman. It's kind of hard to put those things on him.
So there is no subtext then.
What's not hard to put on it, though, is that the themes of the movie, and he didn't write the book, but the movie's changed from the book. The theme of the movie, and Ernest Thesinger's character specifically, is very gay-coded. They're letting him camp it up.
I am.
As far as you can in 1935. He even has lines that are so.
Son of a bitch. I'm looking back at it now with hindsight. I didn't even catch it. I just thought he was having fun. I didn't read any kind of coding. I thought.
The thing people read into it that's the easiest to see is The Outsider, the outcast who's not normal in society, who finds a mate and she rejects the heteronormal relationship. That's the way people like to read the ending.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Man.
I don't think that's a James Whale thing. I think that's just a great ending. Move on. Well, the James Whale thing is Ernest Thesiger, who there's a line cut from the movie that would just say it so explicitly when he says to Henry Frankenstein, the line's in there where he's like, go forth and procreate or whatever. There's a line in there. He's like, you can do it by the normal means. It's like, I have to find other ways.
Wow.
It's saying amongst, the creation of life for him. Yes.
But you know what? I don't know that I would have got it even if you kept the line in because...
Well, they got it in 1935.
They're smarter than me in 1935, apparently.
Well, then why aren't they alive still?
I don't know. I guess they're not that smart.
How smart can they be? I'm still here.
Not very smart. I forgot. I really don't like people from olden times.
So people that were close to James Whale, they just dismiss out of hand there's any kind of his sexuality put into the movie because they just argue he's an artist first and foremost. He didn't care. Like... He just didn't see it as like anybody else's issue or even his issue. It's like, it is what it is.
And right.
I get that, but I go back to the Romero thing and there's just, you can't keep your view out of things, especially when this is the one that you got to make all on your own. Like nobody gave you notes. There were cuts made here and there, obviously, but he got no oversight. He got to make the movie. He had full control over everything. And this is the one that the campy guy shows up as the bad guy. And it's just, he's playing it so effeminately for 1935. There's nothing like it. It's the theatrical English part, sure, but Thesiger's just going for it.
He was the best part of the movie, for me anyway.
I think he's the best part of any movie.
I like that crazy old lady, the villager too.
Yes. She's the count's assistant. She works for
She just seemed like a crazy old lady.
Yeah.
That's all I got for a
They put her in to do some comedy because again, he just didn't want to make the same movie again.
it was such a tonal shift. You get Frankenstein's monster murdering people left and right, and then you get her just running around screaming like a chicken. It is fun. You know what? I think I did enjoy this movie.
Well, her character is included in Thesiger's character to put a lot of comedy, and my favorite moment in the movie is when they tell him to go away, and he just walks up the other door.
And shut up. They kept telling her to shut up a lot. No,
just when Thesiger, she's like, okay, I'll tell him, and she goes out the bottom door, and then he just comes in the top door and is like, Frankenstein.
I didn't see that. I didn't even notice that part.
Yeah, because it's all for camp. It's all hamming it up. But he's deadly serious about what he's trying to do.
Oh, yeah. He's insane. He's an insane person.
And the emotional climax of Frankenstein's monster understanding that you're one of us, you're a monster, is great. And that Frankenstein himself has been redeemed and released by the monster to go live his life. Because I think mostly because of the one line he says when he's like, I can't leave him now. When she goes to, which is like, I'm not leaving without you. He's like, I can't leave him now. Because he finally learned the mistake he made in the first one. I've always argued that the difference between the book and the movie Frankenstein is that in the book, the lesson is don't play God. In the movie, he doesn't get punished for playing God. The punishment comes from failing to teach the monster anything.
For rejecting him out of hand?
He doesn't even reject him because he has a side character, a sidekick there, not an Igor, they name it something else, who's very abusive to the monster and the monster gets out to escape him, basically.
Okay.
And he only knows cruelty and he doesn't get to make his own decisions ever. He only doesn't understand the world through two movies. In fact, the only decision he really ever makes in the series is to end their lives at the end of the second one. That's his autonomy finally coming through.
Okay.
And the choice he makes to tell Thesiger, to Pretorius, like, you stay.
Because you're one of us.
We belong dead. And he means you. And he means himself because this world is horrible. And he means her because he doesn't want her to go through it too. And it's a very emotional ending, I think.
Yeah, but if I came back, I don't think I'd be too upset. I'd be happy that I'm back. And I can go like...
Well, just look at the world, though. The only kindness he ever was shown was from that blind hermit. Which is great stuff. That's a scene that's so good. I can't believe it wasn't in the first one. Like, how do you take that out of the book and not want that part in there?
Well, I don't know what the first one was because, again, I haven't seen it. this was a very tight little movie that didn't take too long. The Bride of Frankenstein, I was actually surprised that she only shows up in the third act.
It's the least amount of screen time you could possibly have for something that's become so iconic that to this day it exists as one of the most famous and popular monsters in the history of horror.
I just, a little while ago, a cashier had the Bride of Frankenstein on her forearm. Sure. It was fantastic. It was a great tattoo.
That's how
good. Instantly recognizable.
That's how good the design is. But also her performance, that bird-like
looking
around, the hiss.
That was cool.
She can't scream at first. It's perfect.
That was pretty cool. See, I think I'm a fan of this movie.
I love this movie.
It's very fun for a movie that came out so very long ago.
And that's part of the thing that makes it so perfect to me, is that I don't think there was ever a better horror movie prior to 1935's Bride of Frankenstein. Now, some people love Nosferatu. I get it. I love it too. It's great. I don't like it as much as Bride of Frankenstein, so it's my favorite movie I've seen up to that point in time. I don't think anything gets close to it until 1960. That's a long time. We're talking about the first 80 years of film.
What would get close to it in the 60s?
Psycho.
All right.
I don't think there's anything until Psycho that I consider to be as good or arguably better than Bride of Frankenstein. That's people started making their horses running in 1880. We're talking 80 years of film. I think this stood alone as not just the best sequel, but the best horror movie of all time. And through its use of comedy, its use of score, and the way that it sequelizes it, I think it's the most influential movie in the genre.
You're making a lot of solid arguments here that I'm now looking back at and find the bird, like that, the way she played the bride was amazing. It's creepy. She doesn't want to be there. Everything
just
is conveyed.
Just think of the balls of naming your movie Bride of Frankenstein and then holding off the reveal until the last 3 minutes, and that's all you get. And then it pays off in a way that's unforgettable. That's a masterpiece.
And it stands the test of time, but it is the Bride of Frankenstein.
Well,
that is my understanding.
That is, the poster says the Bride of Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
The title card says Bride of Frankenstein.
I did see that. That throws some counterweight to my argument.
Well, it's 50-50 feet wherever you go. The book I read, critically acclaimed biography of James Whale, The Bride of Frankenstein everywhere. Book I bought about the actual movie itself, Bride of Frankenstein. Everything is 50-50.
I feel like it's Bride of Frankenstein.
I do too. And the reason I did the tiebreaker, even though the title card being Bride of Frankenstein should be enough, because that's the thing that James Whale would have had to say over.
That makes sense.
Is that everything that's taken from it, whether it be Bride of Chucky or Bride of the Killer Pinata, does not say The Bride of Chucky.
Bride of the Killer Tomatoes.
That isn't a movie.
Oh, yes, it is in my head. I don't know why George Clooney hasn't already done it.
Can we get him back and Anthony Stark?
What are they doing these days?
I think one's doing better than the other.
Yeah, but I haven't seen anything that he's been in lately. Talking about Stark.
I was going to say.
What has Clooney done lately?
That can't be his name, because his name would be Tony Stark. And yet I feel like it is his name, but it has an E at the end.
Okay. Whew. Mystery solved. What has Clooney done? Nothing. He was in that movie with Sandra Bullock where he floats away in space.
That was 11 years ago.
Yeah. What's he done then? Since then?
I think he was in The Flash.
The Flash. Hmm. Oh, yeah, he was. Speaking of The Flash, that had Nick Cage, and you know what time it is now.
Oh, no.
It's time for Nick Cage stuff. What do you want? You want a Nick Knack Fact or Nick Cage News? I kind of got both. And I can always give you a Cage Quiz hotshot.
You never give me a Cage Quiz hotshot. You get mad at me that you
can't. I get mad because we don't have people around. It is tough to give a... I guess I could play with you. Oh, man. But I do have some important... This one isn't really Nick News. This is more like Nick Cage detective work that I've done. So, he said he's done with movies, right? He's only got 3 or 4 left.
I've heard that, but there's four...
That are already coming out. I know. But he said he's open to TV. Yeah. You know a TV show is coming out soon? That Spider-Man Noir. I'm not even going to wait for you. That Spider-Man Noir TV show. And he played the Spider-Man Noir in the...
You know, I might have gotten to that.
Okay, but I'm just saying, I think he might be in the TV show.
Wow. Is it a cartoon?
I have no idea. I think it's live action, actually.
That's ridiculous.
It probably is a cartoon. You know...
Spider-Man's a 60-year-old man.
I didn't do a lot of research. Well, he just wears the trench coat and he punches people, and he's Nick Cage.
That's true. George Clooney was in Ticket to Paradise. The last thing.
Ticket to Paradise?
He's in a movie called Ticket to Paradise. And then he was in The Flash. And then he directed that rowing movie last year that was Oscar bait that they didn't bite on.
Never heard of it.
The Boys in the Boat or something like
Boys
that.
In the Boat.
It was like,
oh, the rowboat movie. I saw a trailer for that somewhere.
Oh my God. I thought I was like making up a funny one. It's actually called The Boys in the Boat. I thought it was The Boys in something. And I was like, it can't be that dumb. So I went with it and it was that dumb.
Was this just a joke that Clooney was trying to pull? Like, they'll give me an Oscar for it, and look what I named it.
I don't know, but his next movie is called Wolves, and I feel like it's a movie I'm going to accidentally watch.
And then review for a full moon review?
That seems right, doesn't it? Two professional fixers find themselves hired for the same job. I'm going to get 3/4 with that movie and get really mad at it one day. But I got to look up Revenge of the Killer Tomato.
All right.
A zero-star movie that we both really like, Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
It's zero stars?
It is. His name is Tony Stark.
Yeah. I guess with an E?
Yeah. That's crazy.
So it's T-O-N-E Stark. Interesting.
This person was born in... It doesn't tell me. He's one of those guys that doesn't know. I was going to say, somebody knows Tony Stark is by the time they're naming their kid Anthony Stark. You know what you're doing if your name's Stark.
Yeah, you do. Right? I'm trying to think. I feel like I know people who have done that.
You know what, though? He was probably born before 1960.
I can't do that math.
Because if he was 88, now he's probably like right in that wheelhouse of right when it came out.
Somebody was really into this Iron Man comic book they read. So I'm going to name my kid that.
Movie came out in 88. How old do you think he was in that movie? Because he's probably...
20.
I think he's older than that.
40.
Somewhere in between.
Okay.
And this is an old classic 20 to 50.
Okay, I'm in that wheelhouse.
The reason I've always loved Bride of Frankenstein is kind of just all of the above. It's remarkable for its time, and watching Whale's career and how movies are shifting and changing from the way that they're filmed to the way they're rehearsed to the way that they're scored. This is like the one that came together right in that moment of time, and he had full control and full mastery of his craft. And it was the last time he was going to have it. It's the first time he had it. It's just kind of like an apex of everything he learned and everything he could do. And he just, from set design to rehearsing the actors to the comedy to whatever you want. And
it's all in there.
It's a perfect movie. And I think it's never been done before at that point. Something at this level of I didn't want to say technique and genius all rolled into one.
All right. I gotcha. I think Frankenstein was my least favorite character in the movie. I cared nothing for his growth.
Even with the hermit?
Even with the hermit. I don't know.
I mean, Pretorius is the best character.
Right. I think I was really just wanted Pretorius to come back on screen.
And despite Clive having his problems, he's just an endlessly fascinating character because he's the wild-eyed doctor who learned. And it's an interesting thing.
He's still crazy.
He is. But he knows better. And he's forced to do it again. But once he's in there, sure, he's interested when he's in there. But you see the difference now. He says, we need a new heart. And then... Their new Igor slips up, and he's like, oh, it's a fresh one. And then Pretorius knows what he's doing, and he's like, where'd you get that? And it's like, yeah, he's not into this anymore.
The park. I found it in the park.
He has the best, the most famous thing he ever did, clearly, was the It's Alive, It's Alive.
Who? Also, Clive. By the way, Henry Frankenstein, I forgot, is his first name Henry in the book?
No.
Because it was Victor. A weird, okay, that's right, it's Victor, yes, Victor von Doom.
Yes, so who knows why, I think it was in the play, it was Henry, so they just adapted the play.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Good old Henry Frankenstein.
Yep, that's one that didn't stick. Everything else about the monster stuck, the story stuck, but this one didn't, that one didn't. People think it's Victor Frankenstein. So his It's Alive, It's Alive part in the original Frankenstein is the most famous thing he ever did. It's one of the most famous things in film history. Great moment. But there's a better moment right afterwards that was originally cut from the movie for being blasphemous. And was rediscovered and put back into the movie in the 50s, I think. There was two parts of that movie that were cut for screenings and then later put back into the movie. One was when he throws a little girl into the water, the famous scene.
Oh,
okay. They used to cut away right before she hit the water.
Oh.
And now you can see the bubbles and that he's scared, doesn't know what he just did. It's better that way, but 1931, they didn't want it. The other thing is, he has a line in the first movie that is so brilliant where... He does, It's Alive, It's Alive, and it used to cut right there. And then, I mean, not that we would have seen it that way, because post-50, it was put back in. Where he says, somebody said, I think the line was like, you know, good God, Henry, get a hold of yourself. And then he says something like, he's like, God. He's like, oh, now I know what it's like to be God. But he's not talking to them. He's literally looking up, and he can't contain how excited he is and the power he feels and how he's shaking. And it's one of the greatest performance moments I've ever seen, ever. And then this time you get him, and he has traces of it, but he's broken. And that's why Clive drinking as bad as it would be for him 2 years later really worked for the role, because you could see the deadness that wasn't there anymore, but it was still in there.
100% though, and that's alcoholism. I see that now, but you're right, because he looked like somebody who was defeated. There was just this air about him, that whole performance, that defeated, but the energy was still there.
His character in this one is like, it's like the Icarus story, if Icarus wings melt, but then somehow he still had to live through it. Like he landed on Earth and he's like, oh fuck.
Now I gotta go to work.
But also, I learned how to fly, and now I'm stuck. And it's like, it's interesting character. And I don't think they were doing that in 35. I don't think they do that now. I don't think they do that in 2024. I just watched that Godzilla Kong sequel. Nobody's learning lessons. Nobody's growing.
I haven't seen it, but I think Godzilla learned a lesson.
Oh God. Yeah. He learned
how to be pink, or she. I don't know what the gender of Godzilla is. I like to think that it's genderless. It's kind of, Godzilla is for everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone can be Godzilla if you work really hard and eat your vegetables and do good at school.
Yes. You too can be a Godzilla.
You too.
You too.
Oh, no. I don't like that band.
Me either. This is a classic Pete didn't like when he watched, and now he's like, oh, now that you mention things, they do stand out as being interesting.
Well, the problem is black and white movies, I instantly... Oh, also, by the way, there was a surprising amount of cleavage in these movies for...
Yes.
Back, when I think black and white movies, I think of, like, you know, the one-piece bathing suits that everyone has to wear, like, just full-on...
And this was the post-code, too, so things were much...
Tighter.
Yes, including their corsets.
But I don't remember, I guess that's not something that I remember from movies of that time, except for the B movies much later.
No, the movie's playing as dangerously as it can. There's Christian iconography.
Was there?
There is. And they made them cut.
Oh, the crosses.
They made them cut the one where it's clearly him being like crucified almost with the same pose. But they put crosses all over that graveyard to make sure you understood exactly what they were going for when they were stringing them up.
Yep.
Because they weren't allowed to show it.
Okay. Well, guess what? Didn't work for me. I missed it.
They also spend a shocking amount of time around dead bodies. That's always the stuff I think we'll get in trouble, but I guess it's kind of like it is now, where it's like, violence, fine, but you keep that nudity out of here.
Yeah. You're right. There was a lot of death.
Yeah.
There was
Pretorius just has a full-on conversation with a skull, and he thinks it's a hilarious conversation. Whatever that skull's saying to him is the funniest shit he's ever heard.
I like that Frankenstein's monster. It was like, oh, I trust this guy. I wander into this conversation with the skull, and this is a guy I want to hang with.
Well, that, to me, is... I mean, that's the scene I used for the opening. It's such a perfect showing of the monster who's been treated like nothing but garbage. Nothing but garbage for one person. Pretorius doesn't treat him like garbage.
Nope.
And that's why he goes so willingly along with his plan. Because he thinks... friend.
Oh, and then that's a lot of growth for Frankenstein's monster when he realizes
it's
not a friend.
He's a monster.
I don't like it. I don't like a quitter. I don't like a quitter, Brian. That's what Frankenstein's monster is. That's it. That's what I realize. I don't like Frankenstein. Here's another thing.
Isn't the titular character of this movie Elizabeth?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so James Whale, it was brought to his attention. He's not a dumb person. He was brought to his attention that the title makes no sense. And he goes, who cares? That was like his reaction. Who cares? It's a great title. Who gives a shit?
Right.
So...
And it is a great title.
It wasn't a mistake. He knew. He's like, I understand. Who gives a shit?
All right.
Because Thesinger Pretorius just says, The Bride of Frankenstein, which I think is how people misunderstand the title of the movie, because that's the way he says it. That's not the Bride of Frankenstein. It's the Bride of the Monster. The monster's name is not Frankenstein. He literally asks him in the clip, do you know who Henry Frankenstein is and who you are? Do you know who he is?
I didn't think about that example, but yes.
But they wanted the title. And it's a great title. It's an influential title. We see Bride Ofs all the time. Bride of Reanimator. Bride of Chucky. Bride of the Killer Pinata. They're everywhere. Bride movies come out everywhere. There's a new Bride movie being made.
What is it? 90 Day Bride?
Not a thing I know of.
I think that's a TV show.
Is this some reality show?
Probably.
I think there's something like that, probably.
All I watch is reality shows. It's where I get all my good news. I keep up to date on things.
I don't know that watching Frankenstein... would have changed your opinion of it one way or the other, except to see maybe just the, I think, exponential growth in the film, in the production.
Okay. I don't know. I all of these, it's funny. I like the Universal Monsters a lot. They're just fun to me. I remember them from childhood, but I've never watched them since childhood. So I don't remember the films themselves. I just remember liking them as a kid. Something about them was... memorable. And it's that Bride of Frankenstein.
It's my favorite one.
That face, that scream, that inability to talk, the way she moves, everything about her.
It's always been my favorite of the Universal Monster movies. And it now seems to be, pardon the pun, universally accepted as the best one. Because I don't see any lists anymore where it's not number one. I don't feel like that was always the case growing up. But I feel like it's somehow broke through. I think the humor is what does it.
It's very modern. Yes. There's a ton of humor in it.
It is the perfect combination of stuff that holds up now, but also stuff that is so like West End England in the 1930s theatrical.
Yeah, everyone was British.
Yes.
Like, okay,
He loved working with British casts. He got full control. He got full control over what he did.
Oh, he got the Adam Sandler thing. He can just invite his friends.
Yep, he got his Netflix deal.
His Netflix deal.
David Spade is going to be there.
Is Rob Schneider still allowed? I don't remember.
I don't know. I think they had a falling out.
I feel like they did.
Oh, breaks your heart, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess so.
So yeah, he gets to make his thing, and he's like, I'm going to get... Well, if you don't have full control, you're not putting Ernest Thesinger in this movie, because... Ernest Thesinger wasn't getting movies like this, and now he's just prancing it up. And I don't mean that in a homophobic way. I just mean he's prancing it up in this movie. He knows what he's doing.
He's just fantastic, though.
The best.
Pretorius walks in, and I wanted to watch Pretorius. Another reason I don't like Frankenstein so much is because he kills, first off, the bride, and I want the bride to kind of stick around, and she didn't have a choice in the matter. Yeah. You know, so kind of, you know, I don't know, what is it, patriarchal of you to decide for her? Fucking Frankenstein. And he took out Thesinger, Pretorius.
Yeah. Guillermo del Toro's making a Frankenstein movie, finally. He's been trying to get it made forever. His favorite property, Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. And my understanding is the lead character of this movie is one Dr. Septimus Pretorius.
That would make a lot of sense. I was just thinking about del Toro the other day. I've seen only a few of his movies, but I really love the monster side of the stuff, everything he makes there.
That all comes from Bride of Frankenstein. I watched a thing on YouTube recently of him introducing Bride of Frankenstein to a festival and just talking about his history with it and how it inspired him to do everything he's ever done. And he thinks it's the perfect movie. And Neil Gaiman had a similar thing where he's like, you know, I was growing up and they told you these are the good movies. So I watched Frankenstein and I was kind of like disappointed with it. I didn't understand what was so good about it. And then Bride of Frankenstein came on and it's so weird. There's little people in jars.
Oh, yeah. Holy shit. I completely forgot about that.
The movie's so weird. Thesinger's like nothing you've ever seen on screen before, or I argue since. And it's such a weird movie. And he's like, and then it ends and you're like, what did I just watch? He's like, but I watch it every 2 years or so because I'm still trying to figure out what I just watched. It's his favorite movie.
I completely forgot that was how Frankenstein had created life by reanimating the dead. And Pretorius just created life whole cloth. Yeah. But what he created was little midgets in jars. And they just had like a chair. There was a queen who sat in her little crown or her little throne and waved. There were people, the king kept trying to sneak out and ravish the queen. There were a ballet dancer, and they just had a little jar to live in. It was the weirdest goddamn thing.
And the devil. And Pretorius has the self-awareness to make a joke.
That it looks like him. He resembles
me, don't you think? Or perhaps I'm being, whatever the word is.
Oh, I don't remember.
He's like, he's giving himself too high a compliment.
Yeah.
Now, here's an interesting thing. There was a person cut from that sequence.
Of the midget, the little
munch. Yeah, how many times are you going to say that? Ken.
You know, you brought up Kenneth Branagh earlier, and we know how much.
The tiny people. One of them, you see in a brief shot, you see the back of it, but he never introduces the thing because they cut the part. There's a baby that he's made. A baby in a high chair.
Okay.
That baby is played by Billy Barty. Do you know who Billy Barty is?
I am shaking my head.
Do you remember
at you blankly?
The little person cameraman in Weird Al Yankovic's UHF?
I do.
Same actor. It was his first role, an uncredited thing as a baby that got cut from the movie.
How old would he have been in the 80s?
Well, he would have been 60-something probably.
Okay.
Right? Because,
yeah, I'm just...
Let's see here. He was born in 1924. Yeah, so he was a little kid playing the baby, but you only get to see the back of him. They were going to do something different to his face, I believe. But that was the little person they used because they couldn't just put a baby in there. He died in 2000.
Of course.
Well, everyone in that movie is dead now. The movie was made.
Well, you had to prove it. You just picked a baby, which is the youngest you can possibly be.
The biggest point I'm making is he was Noodles in UHF.
We got to watch UHF one of these days.
It all ties together. Even James Whale's 1935 masterpiece ties into Weird Al Yankovic's UHF.
Everything ties into UHF.
But the influence that the movie's had is just, it's unmistakable. And just even the Jack Pierce is the makeup guy. What he does in The Bride of Frankenstein, I'm sorry, let me take that again. What he does in Bride of Frankenstein, even I get
susceptible. That's how mistakes are made.
It is. I think that half the time they just screw it up. What he does in Bride of Frankenstein is he has to change the makeup for two reasons. Number one, he's supposed to survive a fire at the end of the first one. The mill burns down. So you can see he's taking his hairpiece back, and he's got scarring.
Oh, that's why he looks like, wondering what that was.
He's damaged and weathered. But number two, the original Frankenstein movie, he doesn't talk. So you can see the sunken cheeks. It's very famous photos and stuff of his sunken cheeks. It's because he could take his mouthpiece out, whatever his prosthetic was that he had in his mouth, because he wasn't speaking. But to speak, he had to put him back in. So now he has a fuller face. That's why he looks a little different, but I think it's worth the having the monster speak. Because Karloff is, I know you don't like the character as much, Karloff is incredible in these movies.
You know how I feel about feelings. I don't care. They don't hit me right.
You know, I love the scene where the maiden sees him, he saves her from the water, and then she's screaming for help, and he's not trying to hurt her. So then he has to start suffocating her because he doesn't understand. He's never taught. That's the real mistake that Frankenstein makes, is not teaching him anything.
You know, I think the problem is that, yes, this is all true, but I'm like, I've seen that before.
Not 1935
yet. Yeah, but I'm not in 1935, and that's the problem that I have, is I have to like constantly evaluate what it is I'm looking at and have put it in context. And I don't. I just sit there and look at the story, which it says something that The Bride of Frankenstein, or,
yep. See, it's hard.
God damn, that's tough. So Bride of Frankenstein is the last thing I remember saying in the sentence that I was just saying.
Yeah, so when you watch it, it just feels like it's copying things you've seen.
Right.
Yeah. But, even though it's inventing them all in the moment.
Yes. That is my point.
It is one of the things that makes these two movies specifically.
No. It speaks to the story. That's right. That the story is so well done and it's so memorable with all of the things it does that it does hold up. It kept my attention, even though I've seen all of those things done many times before.
Yeah. One of the things that makes this movie and even the first one stand out is the cast. They're so good, and I don't think they feel like... somehow doing a stage-like performance for a lot of it holds up way better than doing an acting performance in 1930.
I mean, you can see all the stage presence. Like, you can see it. It's clear. It's there. I don't remember movies, all of those types of movies, the old movies. It's a lot of wooden acting. Yes. I've never understood what the appeal of watching these old movies
are. Me neither. So when you see something like Colin Clive, it's like, and Thesinger, you're just like, what is happening?
Right.
They're electric.
And again, that's just what I expect from movies now when I watch them. So I really wasn't considering the context.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, when you watch the original Frankenstein, Mae Clark plays Elizabeth. She can't come back for the second one because of a health issue. So she's recast. Not that it mattered. The female parts of these movies was never a big part of it. And she's got a friend named Victor, just to be confusing. And Victor.
Victor, you say? I like the sound of that guy.
I can't remember who the actor is, but he's giving a very Hollywood 1930 performance. It's very wooden. It's very...
Right. That's all the acting I remember.
It's very get up and be like, we better go talk to the Baron. And it's like, uh-huh. But meanwhile, Colin Clive's just like chewing scenery around everybody. It's fascinating because he's a very different kind of actor who probably could have been a big star if he could have gotten the drinking under control. But maybe he couldn't have performed like that. It's a real catch-22. And then Thesinger comes in and he's just like, you do your thing. I'm going to do something completely batshit. And it's stuff that will never get old because you don't see it, not in that time, not since then.
Yeah.
And like I said, the interesting thing about James Whale's career is that he shows up, he starts making plays because he's a POW. He gets out and he has some money from winning card games and selling paintings, and he's like, I'm gonna start being an actor. And he can't act that well, so he's like, then I'll start directing. And he kind of gets up, it takes him a long time, gets up, and that thing gets him all the way to Hollywood. And then he learns all kinds of stuff that becomes obsolete almost immediately. And then by the time Frankenstein comes around, it's like nobody thinks it's going to hit. Nobody believes in horror except for Carl Emley Jr. And it hits. And then the poor guy, everything he tries to do gets undercut by everybody except for Bride of Frankenstein, the one he didn't want to make.
The most.
But I always want to go back to this. He didn't want to make it, but he put everything he had into it. He was an artist and he created something that's will stand forever. And then post movies after that he was more excited about making, like Showboat. Like, I can't even see Showboat. I can't find Showboat. You can't just go watch Showboat.
It doesn't sound as interesting as any of the Universal Monsters.
No. And like I said, I don't think you can argue that three of his aren't at least in the top five. It's impossible for me to believe that you could watch like six at the lowest. Because if you wanted to be like, well, I do like Dracula better or and Wolfman and Creature of Black Lagoon, fine. But like, I think the top six are pretty set. Oh, the Mummy, I guess. The top seven are pretty set. You know, the first Mummy, the first Dracula, the first Frankenstein, the first Invisible Man, the first...
Wolfman,
the first Gillman, Creature of Black Lagoon, and the second Frankenstein. And none of the other sequels have that in any of these other... They're all cheap. They're all quick cash-ins. They're all knockoffs.
The Bride of Frankenstein comes back, yes? No?
Never.
No, that really?
That was the entirety... of her performance.
That Bride of Frankenstein. Was it. My memory of the Bride of Frankenstein is like 3 minutes.
Yep.
That's incredible.
Yeah. 89 years of being one of the most iconic screen characters of all time amasses to 0 lines of dialogue and 2.5 minutes of screen time.
That's bonkers.
And it was all, she's the title of the movie and they don't show her until the end.
I just, wow. That's because I remember her all through my childhood. It's the Bride of Frankenstein. That's what she looks like. And I just have memories of her. This is some of that weird, what, the Mandela effect, like the universe changed and it used to be a certain way.
Because she's everywhere.
There were a lot of movies with her in it. And then something happened.
When I was growing up, they used to sell the packs of, like, you can get those plastic masks. Yeah. And you would have the Wolfman and you would have Frankenstein, you know, Bride of Frankenstein.
For 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
She's on all the, you know.
Lunchbox. She's on everything. Yep.
Wow.
It's an incredibly bold thing to do to hold that character off for, you know, as long as they do.
I'm not as impressed with Frankenstein now being the iconic look that has taken over Mary Shelley's version. It's the Bride of Frankenstein who really deserves the accolades.
Yeah, that storyline goes much differently in the book, too. They didn't follow the book very much
at all. Oh, yeah, no, I feel like they really went off script. That's why they should have brought it back to the Shelleys at the end of the movie so they could kind of explain things again.
I like that the movie does credit her with a story that they're bastardizing of her story.
By the way, for credit check, there wasn't a credit check. There's not a lot happening in movies back in the day.
No, but it does have the awesome line at the beginning, a good cast is worth repeating. Because they load it up at the beginning, the cast, and then when it comes on the second time at the end of the movie, at the top it says, a good cast is worth repeating.
Son of a bitch, I didn't even notice that.
It's very cool. It's the same card.
Right.
It says cast, and he just wrote in there, a good is worth repeating. And just like he did in the original movie, the monster is labeled with a question mark. It does not tell you who plays the monster. Karloff is unbilled in the original Frankenstein.
That's funny.
And then in this one,
cool.
He gets top billing above the title, and then... She gets credited as Mary Shelley, and then it says the bride question mark. Both times he did that,
and it's fun because that's almost like the precursor of having fun with the credits as much as you can back then by having that title card.
Absolutely, and he's just there to have a good time.
Too bad they didn't have like the cutscene, the comedy takes that they just aired through the end of that title screen.
One thing about it is that there weren't things like that a lot with James Whale because he rehearsed things so much, and the actors that needed the most help with getting their stuff down, he worked really hard with them, and he wouldn't shoot sometimes for days just getting the scenes down because he didn't want to waste the film.
There wasn't even a ton of dialogue either.
No, he would get them in there and he would be like, they had a lot of stuff having to go on in the laboratory and stuff. He'd get that stuff, he'd hit their marks, he'd film it, he'd barely get coverage. And then, like, if you wanted, sometimes you get way too much coverage, people thought, but he would always edit it together and use every piece. Like, he was...
Some of his shots are really impressive, too.
Especially for 1935.
The big sweeping into, like, the rooms, like, from, like...
That was one of the ones that really caused the debate over, is this what film should be? And
stationary versus moving.
Some of the directors of photography didn't like doing it, and he had to find ones that did. And he found one that loved doing it, and they were like, great, let's do all kinds of crazy shit. And Dutch angles and weird shit that wasn't going on. Like, you know, Citizen Kane has the most interesting shot compositions.
I don't think I've ever seen that whole movie.
Well, in 1941, he just basically has... The movie has more special effects than any movie in history because he's inventing ways to do things. He's cutting holes in floors to put camera shots in. He's out of his mind. But the precursor to that is James Whale, who is interesting that he's doing it because he's coming from a theatrical background where that's not happening.
Yeah, you are fixed. You are stationary in the theater.
But once he gets that camera in his hand, he's like, why don't we move the camera? He's not the first person to move the camera. I don't want to say that. But he made the most popular movies that were using the movement of camera. And movement of camera became, that's how Hitchcock works. You know, that's Hitchcock. They were working around the same time, But it's like, it's impossible to believe they didn't influence each other in some ways, because they were both working in the same medium on different sides of the thing. But he's from England. And Whale was a bigger name when Frankenstein, Brad Frankenstein comes out.
It's a bigger animal, too.
Than Hitchcock?
The whale, yeah.
Well, who's Hitchcock are you looking at?
The whales. Have you ever seen any of those videos where whales are mating?
No.
Holy cow.
What Pornhub are you using? What are your keywords?
Well, let me tell you, it is a sight to see. The thing that comes out of the male.
The Ben Grimm? Oh,
this giant Ben Grimm pops up.
I've heard on a recent podcast it would be uncircumcised.
Yep. That's what happens. And then this other whale, I assume a female, but I don't know, just kind of like lands
no
on
judging.
It.
No judging.
It just lands on it. And then that's kind of it. But boy.
San Diego. All right. So James Whale's career after this, people cut his things to shit. His contracts run out. Stuff starts bombing, and it's not really his fault. He makes an anti-war picture, The Road Back, the sequel to It Was All Quiet on the Western Front, the original. He makes a very famous book that's not as good. The thing is, the first one was based on a book that was great. The writer wrote a second book, and they tried to get it made for years. Then it runs into all kinds of problems because Germany's like, you can't show us in a bad light. We're trying to clean all this up. We know. And they're like, well, what the fuck do we do? So it can't get released in Europe. It can't get released here. It bombs. Everything he does bombs. They also cut it out and change the ending on him. He doesn't even film the ending. This happens to him three more times in the few movies he makes where they're flat out like, we're taking this out. And they destroy the footage so we can never see the good stuff. But the original reviews say, there was a really good movie here. And then it came out. It's like, this was not the movie. And it's happened to him over and over again to the point where he just gets fed up and quits Hollywood.
And then that was it. There was no, he wasn't big for many years. He was just forgotten or not acknowledged.
He didn't know that anybody even knew his work after a while, because where were you going to see it? Right. And what happened, obviously, is that the Universal Monsters became a branded thing. His work got to live forever. And it's, he's got three of the best ones, so.
And you know what? I'm a fan. I think you might have convinced me.
He also,
it's a solid movie.
He casts Peter Cushing in his first ever movie.
I don't know who that is.
Yes, you do.
You say that, but I don't believe you.
Do you ever watch the movie Star Wars?
Is that the one with the guy with the pointy ears and they set their phasers to stun?
Do you remember Christopher Lee? He's Christopher Lee's friend from the Hammer films.
Oh, him.
Peter Cushing plays
Prawn.
Grand Moff Tarkin.
Grand Moff Tarkin? Yes. That was Peter Cushing?
Yes.
Well, you know what they say. More cushion for the pushing.
He casts Vincent Price in some early roles. So there's It's a nice, because those people become, Cushing becomes a horror legend in England, and he's casting him in his first role in Hollywood. That's cool. And Vincent Price obviously is a horror master, and he's casting him in early roles. So he's got like a connection to even like the next generation of stuff he's not going to be anywhere near.
All right.
And John Carradine plays one of those two hunters that comes to the cabin in Bride of Frankenstein, the two that come in the hermit. And he's like, that's your friend. John Carradine is the patriarch of the Carradine family, which has Keith Carradine, who played Wild Bill Hickok on Deadwood, and Robert Carradine, who played Lizzie McGuire's father, I believe, and David Carradine, who masturbated himself to death with a rope around his head.
That happened to the guy from NXS, too.
Yes.
That was just information I felt that you needed to know.
Those are the things that I know about those characters, those actors. And one of them was Kill Bill. He was Bill. And then he
got killed.
He autoerotic asphyxiated himself.
That's how that movie ended. I never saw part two.
He was the kung fu.
The legend continues?
Not for long.
Not after that rope thing.
Yeah.
Or was it a tie?
Probably a belt.
A necktie.
It's probably a belt. Housekeeping had a real cleanup.
An aisle too. I had nowhere to go with
it. It was in the closet.
Not like Pretorius or Whale.
No, they were not in the closet. No. That's another thing that's interesting about them. They just did not give a fuck.
Good for them.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
All the eras of Hollywood where you think it would have mattered the most, the farther back you go is the time you think it would have mattered the most. And they were just like, we don't care. Everybody knows.
That's weird, because people definitely cared later.
Now listen, his career was over by 1941. He made three of the biggest hits the country had ever seen, and his career was over. Nobody could explicitly tie it to that, although there were clearly people that didn't want to work with him.
Do you think if he had stuck with it, rights would have gone differently? Like, we would be more open earlier as a society?
No.
All right.
I think that they would have pushed back harder.
asked and answered.
Yeah, I think people would have pushed back harder. But World War II was coming, and he got out right when World War II was starting and for America, and he was just like, we're out. Like, you know, he's just done.
He wanted to get, he should have joined up again so he could go back and maybe write some new plays while he was in the POW.
I guess so. Yeah, it's his
surprise.
His career is just a fascinating one to me for all those reasons, and the fact that I don't know how you show up and don't have any understanding of the medium, and then within 7 years, well, things change from sound to be able to put a score on it to the way cameras are used. Everything changes, and you make the best movie of that decade, if not the century. That's crazy to me.
It is. I understand now why you have told me that it is your favorite of the movies.
All while seeming fairly aloof to it being that great. He never took credit for things. He didn't seem to look for, you know, people would tell him, oh, I love your movie, and he'd always be self-deprecating, make a joke about something. And he just seemed to enjoy doing the work. And suck for him that his stuff got cut to shit so often that he's just like, I can't take it anymore, and I'm just going to go paint, live out my days painting and putting on community plays for a while, and then going to drown myself in the pool.
That how he went?
He drowned himself in the pool.
I don't remember that part of the movie with Brendan Fraser.
That is in the movie with Brendan Fraser.
I don't remember much about that movie.
Yeah, he doesn't want it anymore, and he's in pain, and he's like, nothing ahead of me but pain, I'm out.
Did he like just take a weight and put it on him and sit at the bottom?
I don't know.
Because I got to say, I don't think I could drown myself on purpose. The will to live would push me up no matter what.
Pretty badass if you could, though.
I could. Like,
man, he really wanted it.
Although, if there was a grate at the bottom of that pool.
True. That's true.
I think the temptation to...
I might find...
That's how I'm going to go out. I'm going to go play with that grate and see what's underneath it.
The other thing that's great about Bride of Frankenstein is that you don't need to watch any of the sequels. Karloff does return for the next one more time as Frankenstein himself, son of Frankenstein. And
that makes sense.
Yes, because this one's actually about the son of Henry Frankenstein. Oh. So they've looped it back around to making the title make sense again.
I see.
But it's not a good movie, and none of the other Frankenstein movies are that good. None of the other, outside of those ones I named, those seven movies, none of the movies are that good.
And nary a bride to be seen.
Nope, never again.
Did any of the other guys get a bride? The Black Lagoon creature kept trying to get brides. I assume that's why he kept trying to take everybody underwater.
Yeah, he got Brooke Shields.
Yeah, to get those tax breaks when you can file as married. Yeah,
Brooke Shields.
Was it her?
Yeah, she's in the Blue Lagoon, right?
Yeah,
he's right. The creature.
There's a creature in every lagoon.
He was after that girl.
Right.
He did not get her.
But let's see here. Wolfman never had nothing.
He got nards, though.
He does have nards. So we know
if he finds one, he'll use them.
Right. What else we got?
No, the Wolfman character is great only because he's so suicidal, and I find that awesome. That Lon Chaney's just every movie like, I gotta kill myself again. Like, how do I keep coming back? This is ridiculous.
Is that what I...
Yeah, everyone is like, I can't stand this curse. I don't want to murder people. I have to go kill myself. That's every movie is, I have to go kill myself. Please come kill me.
You know what this sounds like? There's
Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, where he goes to Dr. Frankenstein to find a cure for his wolfism, and he can't get one. It's not this Dr. Frankenstein. He's long dead. It's like the grandson at that point. The timelines don't make a lot of sense. It's like the Friday the 13th movies. They don't make a lot of sense in these movies. There's a Bride for Dracula, but I don't think that's a Universal movie.
No.
But there's a movie called that. It's just not a Universal movie. So, no, he's a bachelor.
When you were describing the Wolfman, it just made me think of the clip of Groundhog Day, the montage of him killing himself.
It's kind of what it is. He's just like, I gotta kill myself again.
Let's try a train.
Every movie is him coming back to life and going, God damn it.
Let's try a plane.
I gotta kill myself again. I have no choice.
You know what the answer is? To stand in the rain and just look up.
The thing that's good about this movie is that Lon Chaney's good in them. So like those Wolfman movies have like a floor that's fairly high. Whereas the Frankenstein movies, just without Whale on them, they're bad. And I think that the one, Dracula's Daughter, is a movie that people love because it's got almost majorly overt homosexual tones to it. It's become like a very big
Dracula's Daughter.
Yeah, it's become a very big early lesbian film where they're like, this is not even coded. This is just what this is. And I don't know how this got through.
What year was this?
When it was posted, so I want to say 36, 37.
Oh, so after the code.
Will was offered it, and he was like, no, I don't want it. So I think that's one that might be okay to watch, like pretty good. But, you know, did you know that Karloff played the monster three times? Did you know that Bela Lugosi, for all of how famous he is as Dracula, only played it twice in the movie?
I did not know that.
He did not play Dracula again.
Shockingly.
He did not play Dracula again until the comedy version, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
I forgot about those, too.
He plays Dracula, and that's the second and final time he plays Dracula. He played it on stage hundreds of times.
So that was right at the end when he was doing the stuff with Ed Wood?
Yep.
Okay.
Pretty much right before that. This has been like his last hurrah in the studio pictures, most likely right around that. So that's the time that Universal turned him into a joke, turned the monsters into a joke, because they're like, we can't figure out how to make money off these things. It's a long way from what Whale was doing in his movies.
Yeah, but it seems like the natural progression of the franchise. Look at the King Kong and Godzilla. Now they got to go into the jokey phase for a little while.
It's true, and he was the first one to put humor into those movies.
So, all right.
So
yeah. I'm on board. I give this one a good review.
Oh, wow. Pretty good?
Worth your movie. Pretty good for a black and white. Better than pretty good for a movie.
Pretty good for a movie.
Pretty good for a movie.
I don't believe any of James Whale's work was ever in color. That TV thing probably wasn't either, because if it was shot possibly for TV, they wouldn't shot it in color. So I don't think his stuff is all black and white, and most of it's not lost, just locked away. To get back to that real quick, like I think only one little thing is lost. It's not a full movie. It's a thing made for the army, and I think every other thing is just locked away because it was never reissued, and it was never reissued, and it was never put on DVD, and it was never put on streaming. So it'd be nice if someone, like every time we talk about the Universal Monsters, was like, hey, you know the one guy that made all the really great ones? Why don't we just release his catalog and people can watch it on the Criterion Channel or something?
Because I want to watch those movies. There's no monsters.
It's true.
So what do I care?
I would love to see the progression of him as a director, because it happened so quickly when you see those movies. The things he's doing, and you know, it's almost like very early film Jordan Peele of the leveling up that he's doing in these movies, from Frankenstein to The Invisible Man to Bride of Frankenstein, because those are the only ones I can see. And he's taking gigantic leaps in just a few years. And the same way I think that Jordan Peele did with visually.
Yeah.
And I'd love to see the stuff in between, the missing notes. I'd love to see what he's doing.
You would.
Yeah, I would, because I read a whole book, Pete, and I've only read 18 of those. Ever.
I ate a book once. It was a dictionary. That's why I know so many words. It's all right here. Oh,
okay. So what do we have next week? I think next week we're going to have a very special watch along.
Uh-oh.
That is months in the making.
What is this? Oh, is it time for a Scream movie?
Yeah, you'll hear the debacle that is the Scream movie next week.
Yeah, it's for the release of what? Scream?
No.
Nothing?
We recorded it half a year ago in the middle of winter during the strike, and things changed rapidly with the production of the seventh one. So we had to fill in some missing pieces from the commentary where we were going to talk for a while about things that are clearly not going to happen anymore. But you can have fun with that.
It's like a little time capsule of this is what people used to think 6 months ago.
It's a time capsule of me texting you going, we have to record another opening because things changed again. So you can enjoy that next week. And then we have some fun stuff coming up.
Liar.
No, we're going to do
The Do? All right, I'm back in. That is fun. You know, I have never done The Do in my life.
I've never had a Mountain Dew in my life.
I haven't either.
It does not look appealing to me.
I tell a lie, and I brought this subject up. I did have one once, and I don't remember caring for it, which is why I don't do The Do.
I've never had one, and I thought, this is funny you bring this up, because like 3 days ago, I Googled, what does Mountain Dew taste like, and the assumption that at the age of 44, I was going to finally do The Do. And I didn't like what I read.
All I know is that it's sold exclusively at Taco Bell's. There's like Baja Blast and some other such states or countries that have flavors.
I think what I read was it tastes like diesel gas. Mm. So you can just put a quarter in that machine and take a sip.
Okay. I like it.
Or as I like to do, get a little bit from each spigot and then drink it down. Well,
that's what everyone does. And that's what I don't like about the new...
Yeah, but I do it at the gas station.
Unleaded. Super unleaded.
I dare you. When we go to see the next movie we go see, whatever it is together.
Bela Lugosi?
To get a large drink and get a shot of every single thing in that AMC Pepsi dispenser, which I believe has at least 300 different flavors.
I don't like those because it takes too long to cycle through all of those stupid buttons, and then all those people are in line behind you watching you do that.
There's hidden ones. Like, I just want Cherry Coke, and it takes me, every time it takes me like 2 minutes to remember I have to take a Coke first, and it's just a flavor under Coke, even though it should be its own thing.
I always end up trying, like you said, not every flavor, but I get fascinated by these flavors, so I start mixing them, and it ends up tasting terrible, always.
Yeah. Oh, Do you want to hear my quick story about what happened when I went to go see Winnie the Pooh?
No.
Okay. See you next week.